From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Welcome to The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, in my entire ham radio career, I have never owned an antenna rotator, believe it or not. I've never owned a beam. I've never owned, for example, an HF beam that I had to move to point it in various locations. But despite that, I'm well aware that rotators are a hot topic in the ham world.
Well, they are, and it's, you know, you say you haven't had a beam. Well, you know, you probably have had a dipole, and a dipole is a kind of beam. It focuses the energy somewhat in the directions perpendicular to the wire axis, if it's a wire dipole.
Could I rotate my vertical?
You can rotate your vertical. You may not notice the difference. A vertical monopole is omnidirectional, which is an advantage in that you don't have to rotate it. It operates the same in all directions, or it potentially does. I mean, it's affected by nearby things. So, but if you turn it, it doesn't help any. You have to move the things out of the way, the trees out of the way, or the chimneys, or whatever else.
All the radials would get all twisted around them.
That's true, too, yeah. You have to go counterclockwise to the, or counter rotate to the way the lawnmower goes, I think.
Yes,
is the trick.
Yes. Now, you see a lot of antenna rotators for sale in QST magazines, right? And I know that there are all sorts of issues involved, such as how much weight they can bear and torque and all that.
Yes, there are a lot of issues about choosing one. But let's talk about some options. I mean, you talk about not having a rotator. I spent most of my ham career without using a rotator. And a couple times I have used one. I have one I've had now for about 10 years. I've been very happy with tri-band Yagi with my 6-meter coupled resonator on it, and that's actually been in QST, a picture of it on my next to my chimney. Looks like it's on my chimney, but it's not. A tricky thing about rotators is they're not light compared to a lot of things.
Oh, no. And they're surprisingly heavy.
Yes. And they're on top of something else. So, you have to get it there, and B, whatever it's on has to stand up to not only the weight of the rotator, but the force of the wind against the rotator and the antenna and so forth. So there are a lot of issues involved in properly designing that kind of a system, although a lot of people seem to get away with just doing it. And then every now and then they look out in the backyard, and whoops, there's their tower lying down on the in the yard. And that happens, but there are alternatives to that. It doesn't have to be just accept the directional pattern you get or use a vertical. There are other possibilities. You can have wire antennas between trees that are set up to switch directions, for example. There have been a number of QST articles and antenna book designs of reversible antennas, which gets you quite a ways towards what you get with a rotator. And just having multiple antennas with different orientations can give you a lot of the benefits of having a rotating antenna system. So a dipole, as I say, it actually beams in two directions with nulls off the end, particularly if it's fairly high. As it gets lower, the nulls get less deep and it's less noticeable. But having perpendicular antennas for the same band and being able to switch between them can be quite effective. And the nice thing about that is that, you know, it could take minutes to swing that beam around with your rotator, but with a coax switch at the bottom of your transmission lines, switching between two dipoles is something that can be done very quickly, and you can quickly see which one is better and pick that one, or see which one gets rid of the interference. And sometimes you have to pick which way, you know, which is your goal, whether to hear the signal better or have him hear you better, depending on what the conditions are. So there are a lot of times when you can get many of the benefits of a rotator without having to actually have one. And if you have trees or masts in the right place, it's worth considering, because usually it's cheaper, and some of these dual antenna systems provide sort of automatic redundancy. You know, is the band dead or did my antenna fall down? Well, if you have two antennas, it's easier to tell.
Yes.
If both antennas are not giving you any signals, chances are the band is dead. If one of them is working well and the other one isn't, chances are one of them fell down. So with a beam, you can't tell.
But if I decide to go the rotator route, there have to be a number of things to consider, I would think.
There are lots of things. I mean, you look at the rotator specs, and that's the first thing. And they all have a wind load rating, and you have to compare that to the wind load, published wind load of your antenna that you're considering rotating with it. Now, a typical three-element tri-bander, for example, might have equivalent wind load area of, let's say, 5 square feet, which translates to a certain amount of force. We'll talk about that in another podcast, I think. And you look at the rotators, and the rotators may say they're rated for antennas up to 10 square feet in wind load. So you say, oh, I've got plenty of safety margin here. Well, you have to read the fine print. The antenna rotator rating is based on the rotator being within a tower with a thrust bearing above the rotator.
So, what is a thrust bearing?
Okay, well, let's talk about the situation I have, which doesn't have one, in which the rotator sits on top of a mast. There's nothing to attach the top to. The top just goes to the antenna. So when there's any force on the antenna, it's applied directly to the rotator, trying to snap it in half. Which I've done, by the way, not with this system, but in an earlier life, I did that once. In fact, it was at our high school radio club, and it looked kind of funny on the high school roof, tipped over. But so the forces are applied directly to the rotator, the sideways forces. What a thrust bearing does is you move the rotator down into the tower, so there's actually a bearing around the mast that leaves the top of the rotator. So the sideways forces are not applied to the rotator directly. They're applied against this thrust bearing, which relieves the rotator of the forces on it.
Oh, okay. So that's why the rotators, I sometimes see them mounted down in the mast.
That's the ideal.
Rather than at the very top.
That's a much better way to do it if you have a thrust bearing available. Other nice things about that are you can actually change the rotator or replace the rotator without having to take the antenna down. Usually you can just slide the rotator out from under the antenna. The fine print of the rotator ratings often says something like the 10 square feet of rating, load rating that a rotator has assumes that it's in a tower with the thrust bearing. If it's not, if it's like mine, it's reduced by 50%.
Oh, okay.
So I'm right up against it with mine. Mine is, I have no way to do a thrust bearing with my setup. It's supposed to look like the TV antenna that had been there for many years. And it doesn't actually work that way, but it nobody's complained yet. So far, we're doing okay. But I don't know that I could get away with putting a tower there. So from the street, it actually looks like it's a mast attached to the chimney where the old TV antenna was since 1968 when they built the house. But actually, it's a 35-foot pipe mast into concrete with a heavy connection to the house and guy wires inside the attic and a whole thing to make sure it doesn't pull the side of the house off. So you have to think about these things.
So you're not using thrust bearing. There you go. So the rotator is supporting the mast directly.
That's correct.
Which is connected to your tri-bander,
right?
Obviously.
And another thing that you have to be careful about is that those ratings assume that the antenna is right above the rotator, particularly if you don't have a thrust bearing there. Because the further the antenna is above the rotator, the more bending moment you have when the forces are applied to the antenna. So you have a number of forces going on. You have the forces trying to take the whole system down,
yes,
including the side of your house in my case. And then you also have the forces trying to bend the mast on top of the rotator, which is this bending moment thing. And the further the antenna is above the rotator, the more strength you need in the mast to keep it from doing that. So I've cheated a little bit. I have a short extension, or my mast actually extends up about 3 feet above the tri-bander, and I have a little 4-element 2-meter Yagi there. So my system does 20, 15, 10, 6, and 2 meters, all kind of reasonably well, but not terribly high performing. And it seems to turn okay. It's an older rebuilt rotator that I got.
If it wasn't turning okay, you're all the way down in your station. How would you know?
Well, the indicator is pretty positive, and the indicator is actually reading the voltage that goes across a potentiometer that turns with the antenna.
In the rotator.
In the rotator. So that's one way. The other thing I can do is every now and then I just go outside and look. It's hard to do that when you're operating, but you know, I go up the driveway and I look. Actually, I point it in a particular direction all the time, which is the least visible from the street, sort of looking down the elements. So it's sort of the shortest dimension. It's almost invisible, which is a benefit, and that's strictly a matter of where my trees are and where the house is and how far back from the road I am, and not everybody can get away with that. But the other thing that's nice about my antenna, this is a little bit off topic, but my antenna is a very old one. I think it was reviewed in QST in 1982 or something.
Oh, wow.
And went to another staff member afterwards who bought it from ARL, and he sold it to me perhaps 10 years ago. So by then, it was not shiny. And shiny antennas are much more noticeable than dull ones. So if I ever got a new one, I would have to paint it with dull, flat gray paint or something.
Well, I have more rotator questions, but before I do, let's take a break and listen to DX Engineering. We'll be back.
okay, I'll be here.
Our fellow hams have told us how much they love receiving the DX Engineering Catalog. It's 132 pages of amateur radio heaven, packed with competitively priced equipment. You'll find everything from multiband Yagis to whip antennas, the latest bass transceivers to mobile radios, and every accessory under the sun. But the catalog only represents a small part of what DX Engineering offers. When you visit dxengineering.com, you'll find thousands of items from trusted names like ICOM, Yaesu, Kenwood, and Elenco. There's world-famous antennas from OptiBeam, E-Antennas, and M-Squared, Rhone and American Towers, plus many more. And shop a wide selection of innovative DX Engineering brand products. They're designed and manufactured by our team of amateur radio enthusiasts for hams just like you. Plus, you get the fastest shipping in the ham universe, and shipping is free on most orders over $99. Experience ham radio heaven at dxengineering.com. That's dxengineering.com.
And we're back, and I promised another question.
Okay.
One thing we haven't talked about are the wires. Getting the wires from the rotator down into your station to where the control or the indicator is that an art and science by itself or not?
Well, actually, it's easier than getting the coax down because the wires for the rotator don't have to turn. They're fixed. The bottom of the rotator stays fixed in position. And that's where the wires come out. The coax from the antenna has to make some kind of a loop around the rotator so that it can turn 360 degrees without tying itself in knots up there. And you have to be very careful about that because if you try to do that and you don't leave enough slack, you'll pull the cable apart. But the control wires are not too much of a problem as long as you look at the specs. And what you'll find is there are actually a couple of sets of wires within the cable that's normally used. One of them, either two or three wires, depending on how the motor works, drive the motor, and those usually have to be heavier wires to handle the motor current.
I would think so, yeah.
The other ones are sensor control leads that drive the display and allow you to know where the antenna's going, and those are low current kinds of things. So many cables have different size wires for the different functions, and it's important to look at that carefully and make sure you have the right wires hooked up to the right connections. The other thing, a corollary to that, is they're usually spec'd to provide sufficient current and voltage to the rotator motor at a given length depending on the wire size. So what you may find is if it's rated for 100 feet and you have 150 feet, you may need to go to heavier motor wires. And oftentimes manufacturers provide different cables for the different applications. So be careful about that. Make sure you know how much distance you need to cover before you, I mean, you always need to know how long the cable needs to be before you buy it, but it doesn't just matter how many feet. It's over a certain number of feet, you may need to go to a larger wire size.
You have to be worried about the resistance. Yeah. That kind of dovetails into the discussion of the features of various rotators, and you must have something to say about that.
Well, yeah, I guess I do, and I'm not terribly experienced at all this modern stuff.
them modern rotators.
Yeah, being a old-timer kind of person by nature. But it's important to think ahead about how you're going to use your rotator because nowadays, modern rotators, many of them can be computer-controlled, and rather than having, as in my case, I have to hold down a bar and watch the meter as the antenna swings around, which is what we used to do in the old days. That was just slightly beyond the days when you actually had to crank the antenna around, the old Armstrong method. But now a lot of software is set up to be able to automatically point the antenna in the right direction. So if you're in a contest mode, particularly, and you're working stations quickly one after the other, when you enter the call sign into the log or look it up on your packet cluster, whatever, you usually, it will indicate the bearing to the station. And by the way, they don't always get it right. They usually do it based on prefix, and some prefixes are pretty big. But nonetheless,
and the bearings are in degrees too, yes. 90 degrees or whatever.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So they, and that information can automatically go to the rotator, and while you're tuning the station in better or whatever, the rotator is all by itself swinging to that azimuth. And that's pretty slick.
It is.
That's a choice. And usually the rotators that can support that cost a little bit more. Alternately, it's possible for many rotators out there to get a retrofit kit that can fit inside the control unit and actually do that for you. I haven't used one, and I've thought about it because that would be a very nice feature. I do some contesting and some DXing. In that way, you don't have to spend the extra time holding the rotator thing to keep it spinning around.
Oh, sure.
So there are different features of that sort, and you want to make sure that the rotator command structure is compatible and supported by the software you're using. And I'm not sure if that's an issue very much. I would think everybody would probably be on the same page, but it's worth checking to make sure that people have actually made your software talk to the rotator that you're considering.
Yes.
Because otherwise you could be spending a lot of time on something that goes in between them, which may be more trouble than you want to tackle.
That's true. Well, are you ready for a question?
Yeah, I can do a question.
We can do a question. Well, Billy, KV4M, is asking, given the new information on insulating window line contained in the August 2018 QSD article by John Portoon, W6NBC, is it feasible to bring the insulated window line into the shack through the window and perhaps place a ballon 12 to 8 inches from the unbalanced tuner using a short length of low-loss coax to connect the two? I've lived under the assumption that the shack would be filled with RF and other RFI situations would be the result of the indoor unshielded balance line. Is this really okay, Joel?
Yeah, actually it is. It does require a little bit of care. As John notes in the article, and I've mentioned many times, most of the radiation from balance line is contained within an imaginary tube about 2 or 3 wire spacings surrounding the physical line. And that's where you get in trouble laying it on the ground. The fields end up in the dirt, and the dirt is very lossy. So the field, you know, the signal is not contained within the wires, or in coax, between the two conductors in the coax inside the shield. Most of the signal is around the window line surrounding it. So you do need to be careful about that. And any coupling to wires within that zone, and actually to some distance outside it, will be coupled and have potential RF problem. But keep in mind that situation is true only for the balanced load situation, which is what the window line is supposed to feed, which is to say that the currents on both of the wires are equal and opposite, and that's what causes them to cancel. Now, if you have an antenna that's not balanced, such as one in which the one side is closer to the ground than the other, or one side is next to your metal gutters or whatever, or an off-center fed dipole, for example, you will have unbalanced currents on the window line, and the unbalanced part will not cancel out. Now, on the other hand, if you have coax and you have a not properly terminated or balanced to unbalanced transition at the antenna, you'll have the same kind of unbalanced current showing up as a common mode current on the outside of the shield. So it's not that different from coax in that regard. But you do have to be a little bit careful about it. I've had situations in which I've run the window line all the way to the tuner with no coax in between. My previous tuner had a ballon inside the tuner, balanced terminals on the back of the tuner, so the feed line, the window line, came all the way in.
That's very common.
That is very common. Although, note, you don't have to use that. You could have a separate ballon outside if you wanted to. But it's very convenient to go all the way to the tuner and not have to make a transition someplace. Saves you $100 too or something.
Yeah.
But I've had trouble with coupling in the shack, and I guess everybody has probably at one time or another with some kind of coupling, whether they use coax or window line. So, you know, if you keep the window line a little bit away from things, both to avoid having your RF spend most of its time in the shack, you want it to go out to the antenna after all. You don't want it to be talking to people in the shack.
Yes.
And any RF that couples to your computer is RF that's not going to your antenna, after all. Just be a little careful about how you place the thing. So my window line in that station arrangement is a couple feet away from all the other cabling, and I haven't had significant problems with it since.
So what Billy's talking about is certainly doable, especially with the short length of coax, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no reason not to try it. If you have a big problem, you can always do something else, but I think you won't find that you have more problems than you would with coax in general. I mean, you could have a situation that would work with coax and not with window line and vice versa, but in general, the same kinds of problems exist. In many cases, the RFI can be from the antenna itself, if depending on how that is positioned compared to the station, and there's nothing canceling that out until...
No,
you know, so,
no.
So some people have an antenna that's quite close to the house or the station and have coupling directly from that. You know, I think that John's idea was a very clever one. We haven't done any measurements. You know, we did a fairly exhaustive set of measurements on window line a few years back, as reported.
I remember. Yeah.
In QST, and we didn't think to try John's idea because we didn't have that idea yet. It was a new idea to me, I guess. So, you know, the idea is that you do want to keep the window line conductors fairly far away from lossy things, particularly on the dirt and down. This should do that reasonably well. You know, I would actually be happier with something a little thicker, but you can only go so far with these things.
Sure.
And a lot of people try to put window line in, they want to bury it by putting it in a PVC pipe. Well, if it's laying against the bottom of the pipe, it's right up against the dirt, pretty
much.
That's
right.
And you'll have a lot of loss. By the way, our measurements indicated more loss than John's did about window line laying on the dirt. So I don't know whether California dirt is inherently less lossy than Connecticut dirt or what it is, but
probably drier, I would imagine.
Possibly so. And actually, we had less problem with wet ground.
Oh, well, than, okay.
Because it acts like a conductor almost. And when it's a conductor, it's not lossy. It changes the impedance, but it's not necessarily lossy. Anyway, there is loss when it's in contact or adjacent to the dirt. And by putting something like this material inside the PVC, I bet you could actually get away with that as a buried structure. It should, we haven't tested it yet. So just a thought that occurred to me as I saw this, that if you can fit it inside a PVC pipe, might be able to make that work. It certainly would work better than just putting it in the pipe and burying the pipe.
Okay. Well, that's a very balanced answer, Joel.
Yeah. And you have the benefit of, thank you.
You're slow on the uptake.
I am. It's been a long morning, long drive to get here. But another thing is, you know, having the ballon, the big thing about having the ballon close to the antenna tuner or in the antenna tuner is any piece of coax between the ballon and the tuner in a typical multi-band antenna structure with balanced line that we often use, such, you know, center fed ZEP kind of thing, the coax will have a lot of loss because it's mismatched. You know, 10 feet, maybe not terrible. 20 feet is getting on the edge of maybe you want to do something different. And by being able to bring it all the way in, you avoid any of that loss in the mismatched coax. So it's a big benefit in terms of getting more of your signal out to the antenna.
I would think so. Well, thank you, Joel.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.